Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to today's Classic Replay with me, Justin Brierley, here to introduce this week's show from the archive. Now, Bart Ehrman has been on Unbelievable many times over the years. He's well known as a US New Testament scholar who lost his Christian faith. Now, when Mike Licona had doubts, he devoted himself to investigating the evidence and became convinced that Jesus' resurrection is the only rational explanation for the facts. So in this show, first broadcast in Easter 2011, they debated the key historical facts about the resurrection and issues such as whether a miracle can count as an explanation for historical data. This was a really significant show. I found this one so helpful myself. So thanks for tuning in. And don't forget, you can find many more shows from the Unbelievable podcast archive at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, gentlemen, thank you both for being with me on the programme today. It's a great pleasure to have you in. Let's start with you, Bart. Thank you for joining me in the studio today. At the time of recording, you are just over here to do a lecture or two and a little bit of research as well. Last time you came on, you were talking about a best-selling book you wrote called Misquoting Jesus in conversation with Peter J. Williams. I'll put, of course, the link to that programme with the podcast of this one. You're back with another book this year, Forged, Writing in the Name of God. Tell us quickly what that's about.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the program. So the new book is about how a number of early Christians wrote books claiming to be people they weren't. And so sometimes somebody would write a letter and claim to be the Apostle Paul, even though he wasn't, or would claim to be Peter, or somebody would write a gospel claiming to be Peter or Thomas or Philip. And so the book is about a forgery in early Christianity, which I argue was seen as a deceitful practice in the ancient world. People considered it to be a form of lying, and it was not widely accepted in the ancient Roman Empire.
Well, it would be fascinating maybe down the line to get you back on at some point to have a discussion with someone about that book. But that's not the topic we're talking about today. We're talking about the resurrection. Before we bring Mike in, I guess at one point you believed in the resurrection, didn't you, Bart?
Oh, absolutely. I was a very strong conservative evangelical Christian going to the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, and I took courses on apologetics where we learned how to argue for the resurrection historically, and I spent a number of years trying to prove to people that, in fact, Jesus had been raised from the dead.
And what, in the end, dissuaded you from that view?
Well, there are a number of things. I was the strong evangelical for a long time, and in part my biblical scholarship showed me that my earlier views that the Bible was without mistake was wrong, that in fact there are mistakes in the Bible, and there are mistakes in the resurrection narratives. There are contradictions between the different accounts about how Jesus was raised from the dead. This eventually led me to become a more liberal Christian who didn't hold to the inerrancy of the Bible. What ended up leading me to be a non-Christian altogether was unrelated to that. It really had to do with the problem of suffering and how to explain why there can be so much pain and misery in the world if there's a God who's in control of it. And I came to a point where I simply didn't believe that there was a God who was active in the world, and that necessarily had implications for beliefs in the resurrection, because, of course, there can't be a miraculous resurrection of Jesus if there's nobody who's performing miracles. And so I don't believe that God is active in the world in such a way as would allow for something like the resurrection of Jesus.
I mean that's interesting, and I'm sure we'll get to it later on as to what kind of, as it were, presuppositions we bring with us to the historical study of the Bible, and what kind of evidence and conclusions that allows us to draw. But we're going to be doing that with the help today of Mike Licona, who is, as I said, apologetics coordinator at the North American Mission Board and a research professor of New Testament at Southern Evangelical Seminary. He's joining us today, though, by a radio link from Atlanta, Georgia, courtesy of the kind people at Talk 920 AM WGKA. He's joining us by a fabulous quality radio link. So a warm welcome to you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Justin, and thank you for having me on as well.
I'm so pleased to have you on. I've long wanted to have you on, Mike, and pleased that you're able to do this with Bart here. Mike, we heard a little bit of Bart's story there. Tell us something of yours, because you've been through, as it were, your own sort of crisis of faith in some ways. Today, though, you preach, write, teach on the resurrection. Tell us what happened in your story.
Well, you know, we all have our idiosyncrasies, and one of mine is that I'm a second guesser. I second guess everything. And I went to a Christian university. I was brought up in a Christian family. So I was a strong evangelical Christian. And I went to graduate school because I wanted to specialize in the learning of Koine Greek, which is the Greek of the New Testament. And in my last semester there, I just started to question my faith. I have my doubts. How do I know that Christianity is true? It's the only thing I'd looked at. I believe I've got this relationship with God. But then I thought, you know, Mormons think that as well. So do people of other religious beliefs. Could it be that the reason that I believe this is because this is the way I was raised up? Of course, that doesn't mean it's wrong. I could believe for all the wrong reasons, and what I believe is still right. But it did introduce a significant degree of doubt. And so I started to look into the evidence for Christianity and for other world religions, not all of them, but Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, atheism, and became reconvinced that Christianity was true. I decided to go for a PhD and wanted to approach the resurrection of Jesus from a different approach, to prove it from a different approach. But as I started to study the massive literature written by professional historians outside the community of biblical scholars, it became abundantly clear in those writings that every historian is biased in many different ways, and that there are no such things as an objective historian, at least completely objective. And so I realized that this became a serious problem for me because I had my own biases. And so this led me into greater strife in my own life and anguishing over my own doubts and wrestling through my own biases. And so I went on a very involved six-year study, one that did result in not only my doctoral dissertation, but the new book out, The Resurrection of Jesus. And in there, I just tried my best to shelve my bias. Nobody can do it completely. I was not able to do it completely. And then I would, you know, bump off these different ideas that I was having and researching. I would purposely get involved in public debate and try to debate some of the brightest minds out there. That was one of the reasons I wanted to debate Bart Ehrman. I really respect him. And, you know, to see if these ideas would hold up to strong critical scrutiny. And after this time, I'm more convinced than ever that Jesus rose from the dead.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, and we'll obviously be providing links to both your websites, gentlemen, from the podcast of this program. If you want to visit them, though, bartderman.com is the place to go for Bart's resources, and risenjesus.com is the place for Mike Licona. Now, both of you gentlemen, as you've just referenced there, Mike, have met before, not usually via a transatlantic radio link, rather face to face. But in a sense, you've debated this very subject before in the form of, I think, the last debate you had at Southern Evangelical Seminary asked, can we prove by history, if you like, the resurrection? Rather than, as it were, just repeating that debate today, I'd like us to maybe explore some of the aspects of from the Bible. What counts as good biblical evidence for the resurrection, and whether we can even talk about evidence for something which, at its core is a miracle, and whether we can talk about that, is, as it were, in a historical sense, which does take us into the ground that you discussed previously. But as we do that, I'm sure we're going to uncover all kinds of interesting areas as we chat through the issues today. We're looking at today the question, is there good biblical evidence for the resurrection? Here on Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking with me, Justin Brierley. If you want to find out more about today's show, my guests, listen back, send it on to friends, do check out the podcast and the MP3 recordings at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Don't forget the Facebook and Twitter accounts also open for your interactions as well if you visit the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, gentlemen, let's get into today's topic then. Mike, perhaps we'll turn first of all to the book you've written, The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach. Does this kind of bring into what I've heard you talk about before, as it were, the minimal facts approach to proving, if you like, that the resurrection is a reasonable way of sort of, if you like, making the case for the various elements that we find in history about the resurrection?
Well, anyone who studies the past, we begin to realize that there are certain events that are better attested than others. That's just the way the game works. And so what we call minimal facts or historical bedrock are those facts that are so strongly evidenced that they are virtually beyond dispute, and that indeed virtually a virtual universal consensus of scholars who specialize in this subject regard them as historical facts. So whether one's an agnostic like Barth, or an atheist, or a Jew, a liberal, a conservative Christian, they would all be persuaded that these things are facts. They're called historical bedrock because any reconstruction of the past is going to have to be founded upon or built upon these virtually undisputable facts. When we come to these, then, regarding the fate of Jesus, the relevant historical bedrock would be things such as Jesus' death by crucifixion. That secondly, shortly after his death, a number of his followers had experiences that they were convinced were appearances of the risen Jesus who appeared to them personally, and that these experiences occurred in both individual and in group settings. And number three, that there was an enemy of the church named Paul, who likewise had an experience that he was convinced was an appearance of the risen Jesus to him. And this radically transformed his life from a persecutor of the church to one of its most able defenders. Again, almost everyone who studies the subject agrees on these three facts. So that's what we would refer to as the historical bedrock. The real question that remains then is, what do you do with these facts? And that leads to method.
Mm. And as you say, as far as you're concerned, these three facts are uncontroversial in terms of the majority of scholars accept them. And so in that sense, are they in some way free from bias, or is the danger of bias when you come to how you interpret those facts, I suppose?
Well, there's always going to be bias. I'm going to be biased in them in so far as I want to use them to show that Jesus rose from the dead. Others are going to be biased and want to try to explain them in another way, such as the appearances as hallucinations, because they don't want the resurrection to happen. So we're all kind of biased in different ways. It's just when you have a heterogeneous consensus of scholars, that is, people of all different worldview backgrounds who agree on these facts, even though you have the biases, they're still arriving at these facts. So it's like Barth said a moment ago, and he's an agnostic. You know, he had problem with the biblical narratives because of contradictions. He said that in the resurrection narratives, well, that becomes irrelevant when we're talking about these three facts, because even he would acknowledge the three things that I mentioned as virtually 100% of all scholars would acknowledge them.
Go ahead, Bart. Do you agree with those three facts?
Well, it's very interesting, and I think Mike's onto something here. There are these three things. I think on the whole, scholars would agree with them. The one thing there might be disagreement on is his second category of visions, that we have solid evidence for there being visions not only to individuals but also to groups. I'm not sure that every historian would agree with that. But the thing I want to say about these three things is that it sounds like Mike is building a case that he's got three indisputable facts that he's going to build on in order to lead to a view of the resurrection. But in fact, these three facts aren't really three facts related to the resurrection. When you look at the list of three, there's only one thing that relates to the resurrection. The fact that Jesus died is irrelevant to the question of the resurrection, only to the extent that, of course, to be raised, he would have had to die. But everybody dies, and so it isn't really germane to the question of whether he was raised. There's no evidence, no evidentiary value to saying Jesus died if what you want to know is whether he was raised. And the second and third points are not two separate points. They're the same point, which is that people after Jesus' death claimed that they saw him alive afterwards. Paul was one of those people. So my point is that that somebody shouldn't think, well, we have these three indisputable facts, and therefore we're going to build a case that's based not just on one thing, but on three things. Because in fact, we don't have three things; we have one thing.
I mean, going to the whether Jesus died is relevant to the resurrection. I mean, to some, if Mike was engaging with a Muslim apologist, it may be relevant because someone like Shabir Ali claims that Jesus didn't die on the cross; he merely swooned, and therefore any account of him resurrecting is actually just him kind of, you know, being resuscitated in some way. I mean, is it not important to establish that Jesus really did die in order because that then says whatever did happen, if there was a resurrection, it involved coming back to life, not coming out of a swoon.
Yes, that's a good point. But Mike's point is not that he died on the cross. His point was that he died.
Mm.
And so I think every historian agrees that if Jesus lived, he also died. And so if that's the point, then there's no evidentiary value to it. If the point is that he died on the cross, then that's not an indisputable fact because there are historians who have disputed it.
Mike, what do you make of Bart kind of whittling down your points here to say there's only really one pertinent point?
Well, first, I would agree with you, Justin, that the death is important because, just as you said with Shabir Ali and Muslims who deny Jesus' death because of what the Quran says, but it also answers others with the age-old apparent death theory, the swoon theory, some would call it, that Jesus survived his crucifixion. So that's why I included in there. You don't have a resurrection, of course, without death. But even more importantly, historians don't just take and isolate a single fact. When we consider hypotheses and what occurred in the past, we gather as much data as possible. And we look at, you know, the relevant historical bedrock is what I would call it here. I mean, there's other historical bedrock in terms of what we know about Jesus, that he was a Jewish itinerant preacher who mainly preached around in Judea. And he performed what he and his followers thought were miracles and exorcisms, and he claimed to be God's eschatological agent chosen to usher in his kingdom, that he has special relationship with God. Virtually all historical Jesus scholars acknowledge that minimal kind of stuff. But when I'm talking about the relevant historical bedrock, you can't just focus on a couple of those things. We want to take everything, and a good hypothesis has to account for all of the facts, not just a couple of different things. So that's all I'm saying here. These are just trying to have a springboard for the discussion and say, okay, well, here are some things that virtually all scholars who study the subject, a heterogeneous universal consensus of scholarship, agree upon. Now, let's try to find the best explanation for these things. And when we do this using the criteria typically employed by professional historians, the resurrection hypothesis wins, and it wins big.
Yeah, I don't think it wins big, but I want to insist that your first point is not that Jesus died. Your point is that Jesus died on the cross.
Right.
And that's an important distinction. That itself is not a piece of evidence about resurrection. Your other two points are a piece of evidence about resurrection, namely that people saw him alive afterwards, but you're making two points out of one point. Because,
well, it's my case for the resurrection of Jesus, but you're right, Bart. I agree with you. Technically speaking, Jesus' death is not evidence for his resurrection.
Right, and the other 2 points are 1 point. So you've got one piece of evidence that you're going to start with, which is that after Jesus died, people claimed to see him alive afterwards.
Well, I'd also say it did happen in individual and in group settings. I mean, you do have the very earliest report we have in 1 Corinthians 15 gives us 3 post-resurrection appearances. I'm sure you'd agree that this is oral tradition that can be traced back to the earliest.
No, my point is simply that you're trying to list 3 things that all historians agree on. And once you start talking about group appearances, that's not something all historians agree on.
Well, I challenge you to give me a couple of scholars who have specialized in the subject who deny that these things occurred. Dom Crossan says that the groups did not experience them. I don't think that's the case.
I have half a dozen friends who will tell you this, who are all New Testament scholars.
Have they written on the subject?
I mean, can we go to then the question of, okay, let's take some of these group experiences of Christ's resurrection that are described. Mike, just pinpoint a few verses that you believe support the case for the fact that people experienced something that you believe obviously was the risen Christ. Presumably Bart says if they experienced anything, it was some kind of a vision. What are these, and why for you are they, not controversial as far as there being reliable evidence that people experienced visitations of the risen Christ?
Well, the text that most scholars appeal to today, that is pretty much the crux of this, the whole thing, is 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 8. And virtually all scholars who are commenting and writing on this, and they agree that this is pre-Pauline tradition that Paul received from, at a very early date, from sources he deemed reliable, most probably the Jerusalem apostles. When did he receive it? We can only speculate. We really don't know when precisely he received this particular oral tradition, but we know that he knew Jesus' disciples, the Jerusalem apostles. He met with them on several occasions. He was traveling with other Jerusalem leadership, and so he probably received him from them. And in here, this oral tradition talks not only about the death and burial of resurrection, but of Jesus, but also his resurrection and a number of post-resurrection appearances to Peter, to James, to whom Paul had met with on at least 2 occasions that we know of, to Paul himself, another post-resurrection appearance to an individual. There were 3 group appearances, such as to the 12, to the more than 500 at one time, and to all the apostles. So this is very early tradition. It goes back to the eyewitnesses.
In that sense, for those who say, well, these claims are just legendary, built up over time, you're saying, no, this stuff is too early. It could easily have been contradicted. This for you is good evidence because it's so close to the events that they're being claimed that these things really did happen.
I don't think that necessarily rules out legend. I mean, Lucian in The Passing of Peregrinus talks about how legend developed just within a few moments after the guy's suicide. So, and he started the legend himself, he said. That is, Lucian did. So it can start quickly, but I think you're right there, Justin, in saying, the eyewitnesses are alive, that Paul is repeating what he heard from them. This isn't like a game of telephone. This is Paul getting it directly from the eyewitnesses, and of which he was one, and passing along in this formalized creedal formula.
Are you happy to grant then, Bart, that this was is a reliable bit of evidence for the fact that people experience some kind of resurrection experience?
I think it's right that that some of Jesus' followers can be shown to have thought that Jesus was raised from the dead within a few years after his death. And that they claim that they saw something.
And is 1 Corinthians 15 a case in point?
Well, I wouldn't quite go as far as Mike does on 1 Corinthians 15, because he doesn't actually say that that he learned this from Peter or anything like that. He says that he received it. It's plausible that this is an account that he heard from the Jerusalem apostles, although he doesn't actually come out and say that. So he's writing 1 Corinthians probably about 25 years after the fact. And so it's not as if we have somebody who's writing 2 weeks after Jesus died saying that 500 people saw him last week. We don't have that. What we have is somebody writing 25 years later saying that he has heard this, that these people saw him.
And for you, that introduces an element of sort of, you know, things change in 25 years, that there is an accretion of, you know, possible.
Well, I think there is that. But, I mean, Mike is absolutely right. You don't need a long time for legends to crop up. You need no time at all. As anybody knows who has heard an account of something that happened yesterday and the account turns out to be wrong, these things take almost no time at all. All I'm saying is that if you're just looking at it from a strictly historical point of view the way Mike is, what we have is somebody writing 25 years later saying that he's heard these things. And that other people have passed this along to him. And it's not implausible that some of the people who passed these along to him were apostles, were some of the disciples of Jesus.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll come straight back into this with Mike and where he takes this then from 1 Corinthians 15 and these early accounts of resurrection appearances. Let's just fill you in again on who I've got in the studio with me today. I'm Justin Brierley with you for the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking, Unbelievable. My guest in studio today is Bart Ehrman, who is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He has written many best-selling books, including Misquoting Jesus. You can find out about his latest one. I'll put a link to it with the podcast of this program called Forged. But he's actually debating today, is there good biblical evidence for the resurrection, with Mike Licona, who joins us by a radio line from Atlanta, Georgia, courtesy of the good people at Talk 920 AM WGKA. I love the the lettering for the US stations that comes with every radio station. We'll be back in just a moment's time with more from Mike and Bart.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the program. We're talking about the resurrection on Unbelievable, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. Bart Ehrman is the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's written many bestsellers, including Misquoting Jesus. We had him on a couple of years ago on that and the textual transmission issues of the Bible. Well, I'm putting that program along with a couple of others that he's contributed to with the podcast of the program today. Find it at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. But Bart's in conversation today with Mike Licona, who is just an expert generally on the evidence for the resurrection. He's Professor of New Testament at Southern Evangelical Seminary. His new book is The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach. And we're asking today, is there good biblical evidence for the resurrection? Gentlemen, let's continue where we left off. We were talking about 1 Corinthians 15, which, as you mentioned, Mike, written by Paul, is, as it were, one of the earliest accounts of resurrection appearances in terms of when it was actually written down. We'll move maybe on to the gospel accounts in a little while, but you wanted to keep talking about this, Mike. You heard what Bart had to say there at the end of that last section. Why for you, do we have to kind of take this seriously, as it were, as evidence for the resurrection?
Well, we have to keep in mind that most people in antiquity could not read or write. Probably estimates I've heard are around 10% could read and 3-5% could read and write. So a lot that was learned in antiquity was learned through oral tradition. People had phenomenal memories back then because they trained them. They didn't have all the written kind of materials and iPads and everything like we have today. So they worked on their memory. Oral traditions, creeds, sermons, summaries, or speeches, even entire volumes like the Homeric epics could be memorized and performed. So people did a lot with their memory. The Pharisees were really good at this, and they had tradition. When we come to the New Testament and we read Paul, he puts an emphasis on tradition. Take heed to the tradition you received from us. Or if someone stops following the tradition that we handed along to you, you're not even to associate with such a person. So there was a big emphasis on this. So the question would be is, where did Paul receive this tradition from? It would seem, given rabbinic sources and where they talk about how the tradition comes down from Jerusalem, the fact that the Jerusalem church was the capital for Christianity at that point, would strongly suggest that the tradition is going to come from Jerusalem. The question that then would remain is, well, did Paul just say these things to give himself authority, or was he passing along actual tradition? Was Paul willing to corrupt the Jesus tradition? And we can test him on this, because in 1 Corinthians 7, he's talking about marriage. And at one point, we see where he makes this odd statement after saying, hey, you can't get divorced unless your spouse cheats on you. He's answering a question, well, what if my spouse is a non-believer? And then he says, well, not the Lord, but I. And he's not saying necessarily, okay, well, this isn't the red letter edition of the Bible that you're reading here. He's just saying, hey, listen, there was some Jesus tradition. Jesus really didn't deal on this. He didn't deal with a number of issues that have now come up in the church, such as circumcision, eating meat sacrificed to idols, non-believers. Hey, there was no church then, so there wasn't a matter of being married to a non-believer. And he says, okay, here's the deal in marrying and divorcing a non-believer. And he gives the teaching, and then he says, this is my command, pass it along in the churches. The important thing to recognize is that here Paul had a perfect opportunity to invent some teachings about the matter, impart it on the lips of Jesus to make them authoritative, but he refused to do that. He carefully distinguished the Jesus tradition from his own apostolic ruling, which was equally binding, by the way, it seemed to him. So when we are hearing this Jesus tradition, we can be entirely confident that we are hearing the voice of the Jerusalem apostles. And this Jesus tradition is what precisely we have in 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 7.
And obviously a lot has been made in modern biblical studies, Bart, about whether Paul, as it were, kind of reinvented Christianity in some way in his own image to some extent. I mean, do you accept what Mike has to say here, though, that we can trust that Paul isn't kind of turning it into something that it wasn't originally when it comes to the resurrection?
Mike makes several important points. One of which is that there were not written documents floating around for the most part about what had happened, and that most of it's being passed along orally in a society where most people cannot read or write. I think where we disagree is on whether oral societies passed along things traditions reliably or not. In point of fact, cultural anthropologists who have actually studied oral cultures tell us that things get changed radically in oral societies, and that even cultures that pride themselves on memory never pass along oral traditions verbatim. That what happens in oral cultures is that it's simply assumed that whenever you pass along a tradition, you modify it for whatever context that you're telling it in. And so things get changed by their very nature, and they're supposed to change by their very nature. What these anthropologists have told us is that the idea that something should be passed along without changing it is a phenomenon found only in written cultures. And so people who live in written cultures, who know that you can pass along things unchanged by writing them down, have argued without any basis that, in fact, this also happened in oral societies. But, in fact, it doesn't happen in oral societies. Things always get changed. And we know that the traditions about Jesus were constantly being changed. All you have to do is to take the same story in any two Gospels and compare the stories with one another. Take the resurrection narratives. Somebody is changing the stories, almost certainly at the oral level, and certainly as well in the written level.
Well, we did want to come to the Gospels themselves, but what do you make of Bart's claims about oral traditions did involve change, Mark?
Oh, I agree to an extent with that. You know, certainly you could take and modify and adapt to the particular context. We see Luke doing that on a number of occasions, you know, some things, and we see John doing it. There is narrative elasticity in there. There's no question about that when we see this in the Gospels. The question is, does that really apply to the oral tradition itself as it's being passed along as oral tradition? And I would say he would not have the same kind of evidence for that. We do... studies that have been done by, I agree with Bart, on the oral tradition as it's done. And there are questions about which one is more reliable. There are some that look at African tribes today and how they're passing along oral tradition. And then there are others that go back to the rabbinic tradition, which was far more careful on passing it along word for word than, say, African tradition is today. Which one goes back to the New Testament times, we really can't say for certain. Obviously, I would prefer to think that it was the rabbinic mode, but in all honesty, I can't choose between the two because, you know, the African tribes of today don't exactly reflect first century Second Temple Judaism, and second century rabbinic Judaism doesn't represent first century. So it's hard to say, but the amount of elasticity within the oral tradition, I think, was much less than it was when it came to writing narratives used that.
Mm. So you're confident that 1 Corinthians 15 isn't kind of bear too much, if you like, weight when it comes to the possible changes in oral tradition. You feel this was something which was established and was passed along faithfully in that sense.
Well, sure. And, you know, remember who Paul's getting information from. He, according to Galatians 1 and Galatians 2, a letter that virtually all scholars regard as one of Paul's authentic letters, he talks about going up twice to Jerusalem and meeting with the apostles. Galatians 2, he's running everything past them to make sure he hasn't been working in vain all these years. He's running the very message he's been preaching past them. Galatians chapter 1, he uses the term hysteresi to meet with Peter, meaning he's getting a history. He's doing an investigation about the past, about Jesus.
Okay.
So I think there's really good evidence here that Paul's got reliable tradition.
Yeah, let me just give you a piece of evidence that, in fact, things got changed fairly radically at the oral level. Most scholars agree that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are so similar to each other because they have common sources, written and oral, and that John may have access to what the other three say, but he may also have been writing independently. His stories certainly seem to be independent of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. If Mark, for example, got his stories from the oral tradition and John got his stories from the oral tradition, all you have to do is compare what Mark says about Jesus with what John says about Jesus to see if the oral tradition is perfectly consistent in not changing stories or not. And the reality is Mark is very different from John in just about every aspect of his portrayal of Jesus. And why would that be? It's not just because Mark and John had different personalities. It's because they heard different stories as the story circulated in different ways through the oral traditions down to the communities that then later recorded them.
Well, I agree that, again, there are differences within the narratives. There's no question about that. They're evident. But there is a difference. We're talking about, did the oral tradition itself change? I'm contending that remained intact. I am acknowledging narrative elasticity, but that doesn't mean that the oral tradition changed.
Yes, but my point is that John and Mark both got their stories from the oral tradition, and the changes are, it's not just a matter of stretching a little bit here or there. The changes are enormous. In the Gospel of John, Jesus goes around proclaiming that he is divine. I and the Father are one. Before Abraham was, I am. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Mark doesn't have any of these sayings. Is it that Mark didn't think this would be important to point out that Jesus called himself divine? It would surely be the most important thing. So why doesn't Mark have these? Because he hadn't heard these things.
Well, I think that John does do some. He adapts here. He does what, like F.F. Bruce claimed. He said that what Shakespeare did to Plutarch's Life of Brutus, that's what John has done with the Jesus tradition. And I think he makes it more dynamic. He paraphrases. But the claims for Jesus being divine are very evident in Mark, especially when we consider him within Second Temple Judaism. His claims to be the apocalyptic Son of Man, I think, are very strong. Everywhere you see it, Jesus is claiming to be the apocalyptic Son of Man. And this is in every layer of the gospel tradition. It's in Mark, it's in Q, it's in M, it's in L, it's in John, it's in Thomas. It's in multiple literary forms. It's in parabolic, apocalyptic, didactic forms. This is the strongest kind of multiple attestation a historian can look for. And this apocalyptic Son of Man figure is worshipped, he's served, as only God has served.
And he's not called that in the Gospel of John. My point is that this
yes,
is,
he is.
The apocalyptic Son of Man? There's no apocalyptic
Son of Man in a sense, like when he
heals the
blind man.
No, but you said the apocalyptic Son of Man. You don't have apocalyptic Son of Man talk in John at all.
Oh, you have it. It's very clear. And John, I disagree. For example, when you've got the man who was born blind and then he is healed and kicked out of the temple later on, and then Jesus sees him and he says to the guy, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And he says, "Well, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said, "I'm the one talking to you. I'm he."
Where's the apocalypticism?
He said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him.
Where's the
apocalypticism? So you worshipped him because...
Mike, where's the apocalypticism?
Okay. He worships him, and that's something that is according to 4th Ezra and 1st Enoch and the Similitudes. The worship goes to the Son of Man. It's in Daniel 7, 13, and 14, where all nations, peoples, and languages serve him. Latruo, the word that's used always to mean a service that's given to God. That's not just the only passage. I mean, it's you've got where Jesus says all the Father does not judge, but the Father gives all judgment to the Son so that they may honor the Son even as they honor the Father. Well, if Jesus is going to be the one judging and the Father gives the judgment to the Son, this is precisely what's talked about the apocalyptic Son of Man in the Similitudes of Enoch and 4th Ezra. So, he doesn't come out and say the term apocalyptic Son of Man, but he says Son of Man, and he talks about him in the sense of the apocalyptic Son of Man. He's doing those things. He's judging, and he's being worshipped.
I'd like us to get back into the question of the actual resurrection narratives in the Gospels. I mean, take, for instance, Mark and Matthew and Luke, and obviously there are differences between them. Bart, you've could, I'm sure, outline 10 or more differences in the accounts of both Jesus' death and his resurrection. And of course you have things like the fact that it's commonly acknowledged that the end of Mark's gospel, where you get more detail on the resurrection, as it were, after the women have fled the empty tomb, is a later addition. But for you, does this kind of impair the evidential aspect of these documents for evidence?
Well, this isn't the biggest argument against Jesus having been raised from the dead, but one always does have to look at what kind of witnesses you have. And when you look at the Gospels of the New Testament, it's striking just how many differences there are in their accounts of the resurrection. I have my students do an exercise, my undergraduates. I have them simply do a careful study of what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all say about what happened on the morning of the resurrection, the alleged resurrection, and to compare their notes. And they're struck by just how different they are. Who actually goes to the tomb that morning? Is it Mary Magdalene by herself or with other women? If with other women, how many other women? What are they named? It depends which gospel you read. Was the stone rolled away from the tomb before they got there or after they got there? Depends which gospel you read. What did they see there? Did they see a man there? Did they see two men there? Did they see an angel there? Depends which gospel you read. Are they told to go to tell the disciples to go to Galilee, where Jesus will meet them, or are they told to tell the disciples what Jesus had said to them while he was in Galilee? Depends which gospel you read. Do they tell anyone? Mark's gospel says they didn't tell anyone. Matthew says they went and told the disciples. Well, which is it? Depends which gospel you read. Did the disciples go to Galilee or not? In Matthew's gospel, Jesus' disciples go to Galilee. They see him there. He gives the final commission there. In Luke's gospel, they never leave Jerusalem. They're told to stay in the city. They stay in the city until the day of Pentecost. They never go to Galilee at all. So, I mean, up and down the line, when you look at these accounts, there are massive differences, precisely the kind of differences that would make any historian of any other account simply scratch his head and throw up his hands and say, we have a problem here because there are so many contradictory accounts.
Mike, what do you say?
Well, a lot of these can be understood when we, in light of seeing the Gospels as ancient biography and the narrative type of elasticity, the literary liberties that could be taken. For example, Bart mentioned about the appearances. Did they happen in Galilee or was everything in Jerusalem like Luke says and they never went to Galilee? I think Luke is certainly using time compression here. Luke is certainly aware that Jesus appeared to them more than just on Easter. Everything happens on Easter in his gospel, but in his sequel, in Acts chapter 1, he says that Jesus appeared to them over a period of 40 days before ascending. So he knows these things, and time compression happens all throughout the Gospels. We see it happening in the healing of Jairus' daughter. We see it happening in the cursing of the fig tree. It's in all the Gospels do it, and it's a common device in the ancient writings as we read through the ancient biographies. There are idioms involved, so it wasn't just Mary that went to the tomb. Yes, John just lists Mary in chapter 20, verse 1, where it says Mary got up early in the morning and went to the tomb. But look at the next verse. She came back and ran and told Peter and the beloved disciple, they have taken the Lord, and we don't know where they've laid him. And Luke does the same thing later on when it says that Peter got up and ran to the tomb when the women told them. And then 12 verses later, they're the Emmaus disciples saying, yeah, and then some of our own got up and ran to the... Well, wait a minute. Luke just said it was just Peter. Well, no, he didn't say just Peter. He only listed Peter. So this was an idiom that they did back then. We may not do it today, but it doesn't matter what we do today. It matters what they did back then.
When it comes to the women not telling anyone, in Mark. Well, that's an presumably easy they one. Must have told someone if he wrote it down at some point. It doesn't mean they never told anyone. It's just they maybe didn't immediately tell anyone. Is that kind of the way you take that kind of...
Yeah, because if you look at the same grammatical structure and words, they're used in Mark 1:44, where Jesus tells the man whom he had healed his leprosy, go now and say nothing to no one, but show yourself to the high priest. In other words, he's saying, hey, don't stop along the way in your excitement and show how you're healed. Just go straight, and you can show yourself and explain everything when you get to your point of destination. And I would also add a lot of folks, a growing number of very significant scholars now hold that Mark's, the ending of Mark's gospel, that we don't have it, that either it was lost or Mark just never completed it. But it seems odd that it would end at Mark 16:8.
Yeah, so I'd like to respond to some of that. I think that the idea of time compression is an interesting one, but it doesn't really work with the Gospel of Luke. Luke says that Jesus appears to the disciples in Jerusalem and tells them not to leave the city until they receive the power from on high. He's referring to the day of Pentecost, 50 days later. And in the book of Acts, he does spend 40 days with them doing miracles, but they don't leave the city. And they don't leave the city until after the day of Pentecost, and that's after Jesus ascends to heaven. So, in fact, they don't go to Galilee. I think the problem is that in order to make these accounts consistent with one another, you have to rewrite what they say. So that if a gospel says the women didn't tell anybody, you say, well, they actually did tell somebody. If the gospel say they didn't leave Jerusalem, you have to say, well, they really did go to Galilee and they did leave Jerusalem. So what you end up doing is you take the four gospels and you try and reconcile their differences by rewriting what each of them actually had to say. I think that's perfectly fine if that's how you want to treat the gospels, which means that you don't pay attention to what each one has to say. You write your own gospel by combining the four. But you need to realize that when you're doing that, you're writing your own gospel, and you're not paying attention to what each of these individual gospels has to say for themselves.
Certainly, I would grant the narrative elasticity that we've been talking about here. I don't think that there's the kind of precision that they were given to these kind of precise details as we would want today. So, yeah, I grant those. I just don't see that those are necessarily... problematic in terms of coming to the core details.
I mean, when it comes to what these stories all obviously share in common is the belief that Jesus rose again. But does any of this, as it were, detail? And Mike says it's elasticity. There are ways of looking at it which you don't have to see a contradiction necessarily. But you believe obviously there are obvious differences between the stories. Does it kind of, at an ultimate level, kind of take away from their credibility as evidences for this story of the resurrection?
Well, the bottom line, I think, is one we haven't even talked about, which is whether there can be such a thing as historical evidence for a miracle. And I think the answer is a clear no, and I think virtually all historians agree with me on that. But apart from that, Mike wants to look at these as historical documents and wants to ask how reliable are they as historical documents. So if that's the game you want to play, you want to ask, are these historically reliable documents? Then the first thing a historian looks at is evidence for reliability. If you've got four documents that are contradictory at every point, then you say, well, they actually aren't all that reliable. And so if the question is, are these reliable witnesses, the answer would have to be no.
The only point, contradictory on every point, though. The only, just the in only, the peripherals.
Well, the one point they all agree on was that Jesus was raised from the dead. But of course they agree on that. These are written by Christians who are trying to convince people that Jesus was raised from the dead. So of course they agree on that. But the question is, are they reliable historical sources?
It's pretty big,
though,
don't you think?
I think it's big, but I think it's irrelevant to the question you're asking about whether these are reliable historical sources.
Okay, so we all agree that Jesus died by crucifixion. You agree with that. You agree that afterward, that a number of people, and because we've had two debates, and I know what you say in your books, and I know what you said during the debates, you hold that these Christians, early Christians, had experiences in individual and in group settings that they believed were appearances of the risen Jesus. You hold to that.
I don't know about the group settings. I think there were probably individuals who said they saw Jesus alive afterwards.
So you're not certain, or you hold that these things did not occur in group settings?
I don't know if they did or not.
Okay. So we have some facts here that there were these appearances. Some individuals, you think Paul had one, right?
I don't agree that there were appearances. I agree that people claim they saw something afterwards.
Okay, so do you agree that they had experiences that they sincerely believed were of the risen Jesus who had appeared to them?
Well, I wouldn't quite put it that way. I mean, what I think is that I think Jesus certainly died on the cross, and I think afterwards some of his disciples, I don't know how many, one, two, three, I don't know, including later Paul, claimed that they saw him alive afterwards.
Okay. I mean, that goes against what the majority of scholars say, at least in my studies on that. But
yeah, but the majority of scholars are Christians who study this stuff, and so of course they disagree with that.
I don't think so, Bart. Come on, if
really?
You go to the
how many?
I mean, you're a member. We're both members of the Society of Biblical Literature.
Virtually everybody there is a Christian.
Really think so?
Yes, I'm one of the few agnostics there. I could count the agnostics on my right hand. Who are you thinking of who's not a Christian?
All right, John Dominic Crossan does not believe God exists.
Does he call himself a Christian?
He does. So, and so does Elaine Pagels. I'm not trying to judge these folks or anything.
Well, it sounds
Bart,
like you are. Elaine Pagels is a faithful member of the Episcopal Church.
Okay, let me ask you a question, though.
So why are they not Christian?
Would Jesus or the apostles recognize that definition of Christian if you denied the, like, Crossan?
My view is that Jesus and the apostles would not recognize an evangelical Christian as a Christian. My view
and why
is that? Because evangelical Christianity is so far removed from anything Jesus ever preached.
Well, we can debate on that on a different time.
That'd be fun.
Let me just ask you this.
I'd like to do that.
Do you really think that if someone like Crossan, who says he doesn't think God exists, or like my friend Steve Patterson, who isn't certain whether God exists, and if he does, he's nothing like the Judeo-Christian God. He's not even certain of an afterlife. Crossan doesn't believe in an afterlife.
Agree that these people are unusual in the Society of Biblical Literature. The vast majority of people in the Society of Biblical Literature are Christians by your definition.
Are evangelicals? Let me clarify that. You don't have to be an evangelical to be a Christian.
We're going to take a quick break here, guys, and we'll give you a chance to finish this up. But, I mean, I think this has brought us into the area of you know, whether your obviously your presuppositions, and we might call them biases, how they lead you to interpret and talk about the data you have. And that's obviously very different between the two of you. But we're going to take a quick break. We're talking about, is there good biblical evidence for the resurrection? Back with my guests Bart Ehrman and Mike Licona in just a moment for the conclusion of today's program.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And we're going to conclude now. Is there good biblical evidence for the resurrection? And don't forget, you can find this online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Mike Licona and Bart Ehrman have been joining me today. Bart in the studio here in London. Mike via radio connection from Atlanta, Georgia. And thanks again to Talk 920 AM WGKA, who have provided us with a great quality feed from Atlanta, Georgia. Mike, before, as we're kind of starting to wrap up here, I mean, what we got to, I feel, at the end of that last section was that Bart was not kind of totally coming on board with the idea that the resurrection appearances to groups and to individuals is something we can kind of nail down in the way that you say we can, and you said, Mike, that well, the majority of biblical scholars would say that that's, you know, uncontroversial. Bart says, well, yeah, but they're Christians. And it says to me, Bart wonders if there's obviously a bias going on there, that you're willing to look at the facts in a certain way if you've got a kind of Christian preconception. And we had a little discussion about, well, whether they really are Christian, you know, that would obviously depend on our definition of Christian to some extent. But what I'm getting from you, Mike, is that most people don't have a kind of particular, if you like, bias. It isn't necessarily the case that people are going to be very conservative, if you like, in their take, but they still see this as not particularly a controversial claim to make when it comes to biblical scholarship.
Yeah, and I do want to clarify that one statement I made toward the end there. I do not believe that one needs to be an evangelical to be a Christian. I do not hold that they have to be an evangelical to be a Christian. I just wanted to clarify that.
Sure.
In terms of the bias, would that mean that since the majority of Jewish scholars believe that the Holocaust occurred, that we should discount the Holocaust? Well, of course not, because the evidence is strong. So even if a majority of scholars believe that Jesus rose from the dead, I don't think that's the case. But even if that is the case, and that the majority of Christian scholars believe that Jesus rose from the dead, and they argue such, the issue isn't whether they believe because they're biased. We're all biased in different ways. The issue is, are the arguments, is the evidence, is the methodology that's being used sound to show that Jesus rose from the dead?
Yeah,
that's what it really comes down to.
So let me respond to that. It's a good point, Mike. But you're taking an incident, the Holocaust, that virtually everybody agrees on. If you had an event that only Jews believed, for example, suppose that only Jews believed that Elijah was taken up into heaven by a chariot, that he never died, mm-hmm. and the only people who believed this were Jews, wouldn't you wonder if the historical evidence was very good if the only people who believed this were Jews?
Yeah, I have to give
and
that to
you,
Bart.
And that's what you have on the resurrection. The only people who believe it are Christians.
Evidence.
I know, but it doesn't. My point is that if there's no bias involved, why is it that only Christians believe it?
Well, I guess it's a game changer in terms of one's worldview. If you believe in the resurrection, the next step is you should be a Christian.
In a sense, a
change.
That you do have stories of people who didn't believe in the resurrection, came to believe in the resurrection. Well, the natural next step was they became a Christian. It's not just it's a correlation, but it makes a lot of sense as far as it being a correlation.
Yeah, well, it goes the other direction too. A lot of people who were Christian stop believing in it because they don't see the historical evidence for it.
Well, in a sense, that's your story. You know, that you'd, in a sense, you'd stopped believing in God. That obviously discounted a miraculous event being, you know, you were happy up to that point, well, at a point at least in the past, for this to be a historical fact,
the
resurrection.
My point is that it's not unconnected to one's bias, and you shouldn't pretend that the historical evidence can be looked at without a bias.
And I never have.
Well, so mounting a historical case,
but isn't your
grounds.
Bias just as much a bias? The problem is you don't believe in God, and therefore the resurrection will never be a satisfactory.
My
account.
Bias is just as much. My the question has to do whether history can be done on purely historiographic grounds without bias, and the answer is absolutely not.
And I agree.
And
with
so
Bart.
Then the question is, if that's the case, can miracle be a category that can be applied in historiographic research?
Well, if you can't do miracle because of bias, then you can't do anything because there's always bias involved in any investigation.
Yes, but miracle is a special category because unlike the Holocaust, it's invoking something outside of our natural experience to explain what happened in the past.
Okay, so the real issue then isn't bias. It's because it's invoking something outside of our experience.
Well, that's the problem with miracle. I've moved from talking about bias to talking about the problem of miracle, that miracle
right.
cannot be something that is encapsulated within historiographic method. We simply don't have historiographic tools to deal with miracle, even if miracles do happen. This is what I thought before I was an agnostic, by the way. When I was a Christian, I thought that you cannot apply historiographic methods in order to explain that a miracle happened.
I think what we do is we look at the evidence and we try to let the facts speak for themselves in a manner that's worldview independent. In other words, we don't presuppose God's existence. We don't a priori exclude it. We try to adopt a position of openness.
It just reminds me slightly of an argument we've had on here in a different field, which is the intelligent design argument, and that there are certain scientists who are Christians who believe that the origin of life can only be explained by divine means. But there are others who say that's not allowed in science, so your conclusion is invalid because you can't draw a divine conclusion in a scientific sphere. You're saying a similar thing for history here. You can't draw a divine conclusion in a historical setting, Bart. But I suppose the question is, why is that out of bounds?
Well,
why
let
not?
Me ask this. Let me ask this. Suppose we bracket the resurrection and just ask about miracle in general. So, Mike, you and I are both located in the United States, where most historians, research historians, teach at major research universities. And so can you think of any instance in which secular or Christian historians teaching at major research universities in the United States agree on any event in the past that they would label a miracle?
No, I can't.
Right.
But that would
and
require...
it doesn't matter whether they're Christian or non-Christian. They don't
That's right.
invoke miracle because
how
they
would that,
can't.
Bart, how would that be? Because you would have to have pretty much a consensus of people who would acknowledge that God exists, and we don't have that. So I think you'd
right.
have some folks who
It'd
would say, well, this is a really interesting thing. It's an anomaly, perhaps. We don't know the cause, but, can't think of a naturalistic explanation
right.
for that.
Right. It'd be a matter of faith. It's not a
right.
matter of history. And that's the point
no,
of the resurrection.
No, I think it's a matter of worldview.
Well, no, you have to have faith for it to be a miracle. And so the resurrection is not subject to historiographic proof. It's a matter of faith. It's not a matter of history.
So let's suppose, let's just assume just for a moment here that there was no doubt whatsoever Jesus rose from the dead. Would you acknowledge that that's a miracle?
I think that would be the question I would ask. I don't know what you mean by rose from the dead. You mean raised from the dead and never died again?
Let's say that Jesus is certainly dead, and then he's raised bodily from the dead.
And that he ascended to heaven?
Forget that part.
Is he still alive today?
Yes, he's still alive today. He was risen from the dead.
Right.
Could show that. He had been, let's suppose you have a decapitated person, and then you see them come back to life, and they're walking again. Is that a miracle?
What do you mean by miracle?
Is it a divine act?
I don't know what it is. It's weird.
Is it beyond
weird
supernatural?
Things.
Is it a supernatural cause? Let's put it that way.
I don't know what it is. It's weird. I mean, of course, it never happens. But I've never seen it decapitated person. But you're asking if I saw a decapitated person have his head reattached and he lived then for another 2,000 years, what would I call that?
Mm-hmm.
I would call it very, very strange.
Okay. Well, then let's put it this way. If the historical evidence is good enough to show that Jesus rose from the dead, we'll just not call it a miracle. We'll just say, we don't know how he was raised. We don't know the nature of this body in which he was in.
But all you're showing is that people claim they saw him alive afterwards.
I think the evidence is there to show that not only did they claim it, they actually believed it. And the best explanation for that is that he actually rose from the dead.
Well, now
if you
moved,
want to leave the cause of the resurrection as a question mark, I'm fine with that.
No, you've moved from history to faith. So you can show historically that people claim they saw him alive afterward. You can draw the conclusion that they probably believed it. But if you yourself agree that Jesus was raised from the dead, you're saying that is an act of God in history. And you've already agreed that historians don't invoke God when they come up with their explanations. So what you're doing is not history anymore. It's faith.
No, I think you misunderstand a little what I'm saying there. We look for inferences to the best explanation in history. Now, if I can conclude that I look at the evidence, say I know some people in some of Jesus' friends and at least one of his foes had a sincere belief that Jesus had been raised and had appeared to them. And now I go through and I weigh different hypotheses such as resurrection, hallucinations, metaphor, apparent death theory, theft, all this kind of stuff. And when I apply the criteria for the best explanation and the resurrection hypothesis wins by a significant margin, I am justified as a historian. I'm warranted in concluding that the resurrection hypothesis is
why is it that historians, unlike you, do not invoke divine causality?
Maybe they don't believe in divine causality.
What about Christian
historians?
Maybe
they're like you and would say, I don't believe God exists.
No, no, no. What about we just agreed that every historian in every research university in North America would refuse to invoke miracle or refuse to talk about divine causality. And yet you're saying that in this one instance, we're going to make an exception.
Actually, I said just a moment ago that we could say Jesus was raised and leave a question mark pertaining to the cause of his resurrection.
But
and historians
still, but
do this on a
alive.
Regular basis.
Really?
Yeah.
Give me another instance when they do that. When they
the
talk about
the death of Charlemagne. We don't know whether Charlemagne had him killed or whether he died of natural causes in the 8th century. How about the death of Scipio Africanus, the famous general who defeated
and
Hannibal?
And historians say it was a miracle?
No, I'm saying we leave the cause of how they died or of a certain event a question mark.
I think you would agree that everybody dies, so there's nothing particular weird about that.
Okay,
but not everybody's raised from the dead.
Pertaining to the cause, right?
I can see that
when we look, what I'm doing here too. Let's suppose, I'm fine with leaving a question mark in the practice of history.
You want to say that God raised Jesus from the dead, and that's fine.
Well, I think
but
we
it's
would
not
both admit
it's not
that he's the best candidate, wouldn't you?
Exactly. That's my point. It's a matter of faith. It's not a matter of history.
Okay, so I think the thing you're struggling with is the theological implications of a historical conclusion.
This is not a historical conclusion. What you don't understand is that you're doing theology. You're not doing history. There's no historian in the country that would agree that the resurrection of Jesus is historically demonstrable. The only people who would say that are evangelical Christians who happen to have the faith that Jesus was raised from the dead.
So you're doing a I think you're doing
I'm saying this is what historians do. Historians demonstrate what probably happened in the past, and no historian on the planet claims that you can invoke a miracle as saying that it's a historical event demonstrated on historiographic grounds.
What I am saying and arguing, contending, Bart, is that when you take the facts that virtually every scholar who studies the subject agrees upon, and you employ the inference to the best explanation using the criteria generally employed by professional historians outside the community of biblical scholars, and you weigh different hypotheses, the resurrection hypothesis is the best hypothesis and what probably occurred. I would contend that Jesus was raised from the dead and be very happy to leave the cause as a question mark.
We're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. And obviously, we're not going to get you guys to agree on this before the end of today's program. But it's interesting because obviously you fundamentally disagree on as to what is admissible as an explanation for something historically. And that very much obviously plays into where you're coming from with from the original point of view you hold on the existence of God and whether miracles can occur. But fascinating discussion today. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Classic Replay. Hope you enjoy it. You can find other shows with Bart Ehrman in our back catalogue and, of course, Mike Licona. Links to our newsletter, YouTube channel, ways to give and archive at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We'll see you next time.